All right, everybody. So back on the podcast, we have Dr. Eric Trexler. How we doing, man?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing well. I always at this point I've kind of lost track of time of when I've first talked to somebody or when I've met somebody. Like we were just saying, I forgot you and I met in person back in 2000. I guess I would have been 18, which is kind of bizarre, 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So you and Greg are some like the longest history of the guests and everything. But it all, I mean, I've been in three different states now. I guess you're still in the same state, but everything kind of starts to blend together. But I'll occasionally go back and look at like an original podcast and I'm like, oh, I can tell I'm 4 years older, you know?
I feel the same way. I look back at old stuff and the years have not been kind to me personally, but that's okay.
Obviously you guys are putting out content all the time. And one of the things I think with the podcast, I used to, if I got a guest, I was like, okay, let me watch some stuff and kind of brush up. And I almost never do that anymore because most of the podcasts arise because somebody sends me something or I see something and I just want to talk about it anyway. So with you guys constantly putting out content, it's pretty easy to go from there. And sometimes it'll be a topic where it was maybe 6 months prior to the actual recording of the podcast, the stuff just comes along. But how have you guys found with the Strong by Science podcast? I guess maybe even going on a similar amount of time, if not longer, with content, do you find that it's also just people ask you questions and you respond, or is it your own interest that you start delving into different topics?
That's an interesting question. Every now and then we'll respond to like the going controversy in fitness. Greg and I aren't super tapped into the news, but people often will just kind of bring it to us and say, hey, here's, a controversy or an inflammatory piece of content that everyone's reacting to. And so sometimes people will just kind of bring us topics like that. But we do a research review. And like I personally review at least six studies per month. So like if you can't find some shit to talk about, you just when you're that immersed in it and every single month it's at least six studies for me personally, then Greg's usually doing about four himself. And that's before you even venture out into just topics that catch your eye or catch your interest. So yeah, there's never a shortage. Usually if there were more time in the day, we could probably put out a few podcasts a week, but thank God we don't try. We do the one a week, but we never ever end up in a situation where we're like, well, shit, what are we going to talk about? There's always something.
Yeah, for sure. One thing I've heard you talk about recently, and I don't know how much you want to dive into this personally, but maybe it was a year ago or so, I saw you talking about mindfulness and Buddhism and whatnot, which is interesting because I think I kind of started looking into that maybe 2 or 3 years ago. If I recall, Greg, and maybe you're not a fan of Sam Harris, I think, or I've heard sarcastic remarks towards Sam, but he's obviously big in the mindfulness space and all that. So I don't know how that journey started for you.
I don't know enough about Sam Harris to have an opinion. Let me state that. But I have mentioned on our podcast that I'm pretty into various mindfulness and meditation type practices. And then inevitably people say, oh, you should listen to this or watch this from Sam Harris. And then Greg will make some kind of comment. So you'd have to take that up with him. I simply don't know anything about Sam Harris. But yeah, I got into mindfulness and various types of meditation because I got into Buddhism a couple years ago, and I started a segment on the podcast called the Road to Enlightenment, where I documented my journey. It was a very short-lived segment. It was failed from the start. It had no chance of being successful because ultimately I reached a point where it was no longer the basic introductory stuff. And it was like, oh, are you going to present this information from a perspective of expertise? And of course the answer is no. So I was like, well, what the hell am I going to do here? Like nobody wants me to just say every week, oh yeah, I meditated six times last week. Anyway, moving on. That's not interesting. So I let that segment die. A very abrupt death, which was for the best. But I recently revisited the topic. So I've continued to study Buddhism and mindfulness interventions. I've continued to implement them, so I've stayed very much immersed in that world, continuing to practice Buddhism. But recently in our research review, I got to cover a study on mindfulness-based interventions. And so that was an opportunity to do essentially what I had hoped I'd be able to do with that segment on the podcast, which is actually deliver some useful evidence-based content about mindfulness. But, you know, doing that on a weekly basis was a bit ambitious. So this was an opportunity a month or two ago. I wrote a big article and I just said, listen, I'm not going to write about this every week, every 2 weeks, every month, but let's take the time to do this right and actually explore an evidence-based look at mindfulness-based interventions. And so what I did in the article was just talked, I tried to not make it about my experience. I tried to make it just about the research, and I was really stunned about the amount of research that's been done on mindfulness-based interventions. I think I had the number somewhere, but I looked at a particular like umbrella review of mindfulness interventions, and man, I think it was like 44 separate meta-analyses with like over 30,000 participants. I forget the exact number off the top of my head, but mindfulness has been studied a really surprising amount in a variety of different applications. And so in my article, I basically looked at what I felt were the most relevant outcomes for the typical fitness enthusiast. So I talked a little bit about mindfulness-based interventions for alleviating acute mental fatigue. That's something that I think people underappreciate, is the fact that acute mental fatigue has been shown to impair resistance training performance. And that's not a nice thing to hear for most people who go straight to the gym after work, you know, after doing a bunch of really cognitively active, you know, stuff, and they are acutely mentally fatigued. So I talked a little bit about mindfulness interventions for recovery from acute mental fatigue. I talked about how it might have some applications, obviously, with mindful eating strategies, potentially some applications for pain management. And was there something else I covered in there? Let me see. I'm scanning and sleep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sleep is a great one. I mean, and it's pretty, the sleep one's pretty obvious. I mean, if you look at just about any like checklist of sleep hygiene recommendations, virtually all of them basically say, hey, do something before bed that's kind of not super cognitively engaging, something that's relaxing, something that kind of rests your mind. So sometimes they'll just say everything about a mindfulness meditation without calling it that. And the others just say, hey, just meditate, dude. You know, yes. So there are a variety of different applications, and I'd be happy to dive into any particular one if you'd like, or just talk about what a mindfulness-based intervention actually is.
Yeah, sure. And just for everybody listening, we will eventually get into how to grow your biceps later. So just relax. I think to me, I started doing visualization, I mean, maybe even back in high school. You know, we talk about that a lot for sports performance and things like that. My personal experience with visualization, which is certainly different, was more, I felt like it was helpful for people who either were likely to kind of fall off the wagon on a goal, so because it's reinforcing that in their mind, or something skill based, right? Like we've all seen the studies on people who visualize throwing a basketball or darts or something, and it helps dramatically. For muscle growth, I don't know. I did it for probably about 6 months. Literally every single workout before I did it, I would stop and I'd like take a half an hour and I would visualize my entire workout all the way through. Can't say it made any difference, obviously, N of one, right? It's hard to, you know, but I didn't feel like anything, you know, changed. And then going into mindfulness specifically, that was more just like a life thing. I just wanted to try meditating the last few years. I did have Sam Harris's Waking Up app for about 2 years, and I would split it up either between listening to one of the podcasts per day or meditating. And this is something I wanted to ask you is, he always talks about you get better at it over time. And I can tell you, I don't feel like I've gotten any better at it. I take 10 to 20 minutes a day and I just think, okay, it's probably good for me to kind of relax and, you know, take some time. But I just have constant thoughts like every second. I mean, literally like every couple of seconds. And one thing I heard him say in another podcast was that the average person can't even go 10 seconds without a thought. Like literally just try to not have a thought for 10 seconds. And, you know, I haven't gotten any better at it. So I don't know if you have.
So I don't know if I would say I've gotten better at it in that context, but I have successfully let go of the concept of being good at it. And I think that in and of itself is a bit of an upgrade or an improvement. So for a while there, I was starting and trying it. And you know, this is one of the things I must say this. I heard a quote the other day that you can do mindfulness without Buddhism, but it's really hard to be a Buddhist without mindfulness. Mm. You know, the two are very connected, and these various mindfulness-based interventions ultimately have been derived from, you know, the Buddhist practice of meditation in its various forms. And I think if I have tried meditation in the past without understanding the kind of Buddhist underpinning, like why did this develop? Like, what was the initial purpose here? And so I don't think that one needs to embrace Buddhist concepts in order to use mindfulness effectively. But I do think it can be helpful for someone who's trying mindfulness and they're just like, I'm not doing it right and I'm kind of missing the point. I think it's important to say, well, what was the original point? You know, what was this all for? Where did it come from? What was the initial stated purpose? And I think if you get back to some of those kind of fundamental things, which you know, people in the Western world are usually really skeptical about getting into anything that's not, you know, that the religion they were born into, it feels kind of sacrilegious to kind of peek over into other, you know, religions, philosophies, ideologies. But, you know, people have in the Western world really embraced secular Buddhism, right? And so they put secular in the name. So it's like, hey, you're not changing religions, but just like, here are some philosophical concepts of Buddhism. Here's like a general set of ideas that characterize Buddhism. That don't require any belief in metaphysical concepts. They don't require any religious conversion. It's just like, here's just so you know where this mindfulness stuff came from. And I think it can be very helpful to explore that stuff because then you start to say, oh, okay, well, yeah, now that I understand the concept of impermanence or non-self or aimlessness, these basic fundamental concepts in Buddhism, now I have more context for what I'm really trying to achieve in a mindfulness-based, you know, meditation type practice. So for me, it's not that over time I've gotten better at it. It's that over time I've developed a deeper understanding of what it means to do it correctly. And to do it correctly doesn't mean completely having no thoughts during a meditation practice. It means the thoughts arise and you let them pass on by and you don't get perturbed by that. You don't say, oh crap, a thought came up. And now I'm thinking about the fact that a thought came up and, you know, mm-hmm. you just start to spiral. I will say the more that I've read Buddhist teachings, the more I've gotten good metaphors to help me deal with thoughts that arise during meditation, thoughts that are not, you know, so when we talk about mindfulness meditation, it's always mindfulness of something. Right. So mindfulness of one's breath, of one's body. Mm-hmm. So, you know, mindfulness of the tone of a bell that's chiming, right? There has to be some object of mental focus during this type of practice. And so sometimes a thought is the purpose. You know, we might be doing a very reflective meditation session where we are being mindful of a particular thought that is the focus of our concentration. So obviously in that case, you want the thought to be there. You're contemplating. But for other elements or types of meditation, and of course there are many types of meditation practice, sometimes we want to just calm the mind down. We want it to be a restful state where we are, you know, trying to let all those thoughts go, just release them and let the mind rest. That's the type of meditation practice that would be quite good based on the research for dealing with acute mental fatigue, right? We're doing this cognitively straining stuff all day. It can be very helpful to sit down and be very proactive about saying, I need to just let those thoughts go and let my mind rest. one of the metaphors that's been really helpful to me is I picked this up from a Buddhist teacher. I think this was from Karma Yeshe Rabge, but he talks about just sitting on the bank of a river and your thoughts are like little leaves that just come floating by on the surface of the water. And if you want to pick up a leaf and spend some time with it, of course, you're welcome to do that. But otherwise, you just let it float by, you know? And so the goal is not to have no leaves come by. The goal is to just let them pass by when they're not the object of your concentration. So of course, if a thought comes up and you want to contemplate and explore it, by all means, pick up the leaf, but otherwise just let it flow by.
That is definitely something that I have. I mean, and there's a lot of benefits I do believe I've gotten. And it's not like the Waking Up app was my first introduction to it at all. I mean, I've looked into the ideas at least for maybe a decade now, but one of the things of thinking a thought is not identifying with you, right? It's a thought, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily who you are and whatnot. And having those thoughts kind of pass by, I think is very helpful. And almost like in a visualization sense, seeing this thought of as going by, the leaves example is another good one. And one thing I used to do, I don't know if this is just an inherent trait of mine or my OCD kicking in, but I would, like if there were some negative thought, I would actually stop and like play out this full thought. I don't know, almost as if there was a completion of the thought in my mind. And then eventually just realizing, one, you can't complete thoroughly every single thought that ever comes by. But two, if it's a negative one, especially, it's not helpful, right? And if you wanted to try to tie that into fitness, that could be like if you had like a body image issue and just thinking that out and going further and further into it. And it can become a pretty negative spiral, right? Because we tend to put more investment into things that we think about. And then the more we think about it, the more it becomes invested and whatnot. So I think for people who have a lot of negative thoughts, that could be a dangerous spiral.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I always find interesting is when people critique the mindfulness literature, and of course, with any field of study, there needs to be a healthy critique, right? We can't just say, oh yeah, we accept on the front end that this works and is perfect, and therefore no one can test any positive finding. But one thing that I find really surprising or interesting is that there are a lot of folks who critique heavily the mindfulness literature who seem to be wired to be kind of inherently skeptical of it, almost like it's mindfulness has a very uphill battle mm-hmm. to try to win them over. And sure. One of the things I never see those individuals acknowledging is the fact that, you know, they might talk about, for example, heterogeneity in the results of mindfulness studies when they look at a meta-analysis. And there can be many different reasons for that heterogeneity, some statistical, some theoretical. But something that's very important is, you know, imagine just as a metaphor that you were asked, you're doing a meta-analysis. Does teaching work? Well, some teachers are quite good. Others aren't quite as good, you know? So we should expect some heterogeneity, right? If you had a very good teacher, teaching is going to be a very effective strategy. If you had a very ineffective teacher, it's going to be a far less effective strategy. And so with mindfulness, like you said, it can go a lot of different ways. And the way that a person is instructed, the type of mindfulness-based intervention they do could result in really positive outcomes, could even result in potentially negative outcomes. And that's one of the things that I was sure to highlight in my recent article in the Mass Research Review about mindfulness, is the fact that there's probably a U-shaped curve when it comes to the degree to which you embrace mindfulness. There are some elements of mindfulness where if you have an excess, it could potentially be disadvantageous, right? So in that research review, I linked a great paper by Britton and colleagues, Britton. And they basically talked about a set of characteristics. And they said, like, if you have the following four characteristics, you're relatively low on this U-shaped curve of mindfulness. And mindfulness-based practices will probably be very beneficial for you. But if you are, you know, basically have an abundance of these particular characteristics or what they might call an excess, you know, doing more mindfulness might actually promote that excessively and actually have a negative outcome, right? So if you're someone who is constantly ruminating on negative thoughts and you approach a mindfulness-based practice and say, you know what I'm going to do for mindfulness is really ruminate on these negative thoughts, that's not going to be a favorable or advantageous approach for you, you know? So with mindfulness, that one of the things that makes it so challenging is that mindfulness is, in its essential, when you boil it down to its basic elements, so broad and so vague that there's a lot of room in there to do it disastrously poorly, you know, in the sense that where a skilled mindfulness teacher would be able to understand where you're at, where you're trying to go, and say, okay, for your situation, what we need to focus on is, when you get those negative thoughts, you need to really focus on de-identifying, right? Separating yourself from the thought, recognizing that the thought is, not a reality, but is contingent upon a bunch of assumptions, a lot of things that you've been conditioned to believe that aren't objectively true. You know, so there's a way to explore those types of thoughts in mindfulness without just saying, let's lean into it and let them run wild, because right. that can ultimately be a pretty disadvantageous thing.
Sure, definitely. So slightly shifting topics. One of the topics I wanted to mention to you was, I heard recently on a podcast that you had mentioned that you don't know of any evidence that you need to hold on to muscle mass before dieting, right? So it's actually funny you mentioned that in that podcast, because this goes back to Teenation days, like 2009 or 10. And there was a guy on there I've mentioned a couple times on the podcast now, Professor X. And he would talk about how you know, everybody needs to bulk up and hold it for a long time. And then what's his name? Shelby Starnes, I think people saw him in a negative light recently with some of the stuff that came out. And he talked about how he saw no reason to hold on to muscle mass. And again, this is like 2010 or 11. And then later changed his opinion. He said, actually, in my experience, it does seem to be beneficial to hold on to it. I had Cody Hahn on the podcast back in 2019 or so. I think I can probably link the clip here, but he was talking about phase sequencing, and he was saying, maybe with some of his research, it shows maybe some of the sarcoplasmic hypertrophy almost becomes myofibrillar. And this is maybe one reason that it is helpful to hold on to gains. I wasn't sure if that was a topic you'd ever discuss with him. But based on some of, I guess, Cody talking about it and some of the other people mentioning it, do you have any, not a rebuttal, but just more thoughts on it?
I mean, I think with my approach to fitness and science in general is to typically favor the concept of parsimony, which is, if you can explain something with a very simple explanation or a very convoluted, theoretical, not yet fully solidified explanation, probably ideal to go with the simpler one if they both explain the phenomenon equally well, so it's not like we're going to choose a simpler explanation that underperforms relative to the more complex explanation. But if we have two very equal explanations and one of them is very straightforward and the other requires a few leaps of faith, I generally go for the simpler one. When it comes to hypertrophy, I don't really see it as occurring in multiple phases. This temporary phase that if you change something, it disappears, versus you do the temporary phase and it's like a probationary period of having muscle tissue and then it becomes the real permanent muscle tissue. I don't really have much of a physiological basis for that. And of course, you could get into molecular explanations that involve extrapolating and really doing some heavy theorizing. But I think the most intuitive and straightforward explanation from my perspective is that we often overestimate muscle gain when bulking. And I think I've never found someone to disagree with me on that. Especially early in a lifting career, we have a tendency to very much overestimate how much muscle we gain on a bulk. And then when we quickly transition from, a big caloric surplus to a big caloric deficit, we tend to overestimate the degree to which we lose muscle, right? So a lot of times what we'll see is that someone is bulking really hard. They're overfeeding a lot. There's a ton of just content in their GI system on a day-to-day basis. a lot of sodium coming in. They're all carved up, glycogen, water weight, et cetera. And so they really have a distorted sense of what their true tissue weight is for their body, right? Because they're just kind of in this perpetually overfed state with a bunch of water weight and you know, bulk content in the GI tract. And then they very quickly switch over into a cut after that bulking phase. And all of a sudden, we go from this, you know, we're just spilling over with glycogen to a glycogen reduced state. And we go from, you know, pretty much, you know, in a modern diet, anytime you drastically cut calories, you're going to have some pretty big shifts in sodium and potassium intake. You know, we're going to see a big drop in water weight. We're going to see less content in the GI tract. And so a lot of times what we're seeing is when people end their cut, they have an inflated sense of how much muscle mass they truly have. And when they transition into when they end their bulk, I should say, they have an inflated sense of how much muscle tissue they truly have. And then when they transition into a cutting phase, they have a doubly inflated sense of how much muscle they are losing in those initial steps. And so I think for a lot of people who drastically oscillate between these bulking and cutting phases, it could get very easy and very appealing to say, oh man, I what's happening is I'm gaining all this muscle, but then I'm losing it so quickly. And it's because I'm not stopping in the middle. That can be a very appealing conclusion to reach, but a less appealing conclusion is that you're doing these really aggressive, really short bulk and cutting cycles. And frankly, you're kind of doing a little bit of wheel spinning where you're gaining a bunch of water weight and you're losing a bunch of water weight and you're gaining a bunch and you're just kind of going back and forth. And I think, that to me sounds like a more plausible explanation, or if nothing else, just a simpler explanation. And until I have more to sink my teeth into physiologically, I'm inclined to believe that a lot of this concept that you have to, you know, that people are losing muscle because they haven't weighed it and maintained it, I just don't see much of a physiological basis for it. And I think for now, there seem to be simpler explanations that seem to do a good job of explaining that illusion, for lack of a better term.
Right. Well, you know, I'm less about the science, Eric, and more about real world results. Okay. That's the kind of stuff I care about. So
fair enough. I mean, I would say, honestly, if you're a lifter, you should be like,
yeah.
Who gives it? I mean, yeah. Who cares if, you know, what you're doing is correct based on science? I mean, you want to build muscle and you want to, you know, do what you want to do. So I get that. I know you're joking, but
yeah.
No, I mean, you know, that's the thing, though. If someone says, well, Eric, I just want to err on the side of caution. I really don't want to lose these gains. And therefore, after a bulk, I'm going to do a maintenance phase every time because I want to solidify those gains. I'm not going to lose any sleep over that. Like, I'm completely fine with that. And the only thing you lose in that trade-off is time. And that's fine. Like, especially when I mean, Dave, how many years you've been lifted?
Let's see. I'm on 18 years. I think probably very similar to you.
Yeah. So I've been lifting since I was 12. I'm 31.
Yeah. Same.
So yeah, been lifting for a long time. There is no 8 week or 12 week maintenance phase I can look back at and say, damn it, I regret it. Cause I'd be so much further along if I didn't take that 12 week maintenance phase. Right. So you're not going to lose much in the deal, but like, especially someone who's, you know, early in their lifting career and they're like, hey, I really want to make some big strides. I want to get there as quick as I can. Like in that case, I do think it's probably an unnecessary delay by implementing some of these longer maintenance phases after a bulk. I don't see a physiological need, but when we look at the broad spectrum of all the stuff happening in the fitness world, all the advice ranging from unhelpful to terrible, this is the mildest of sins, right? To say, oh, I'm going to err on the side of caution and just do a maintenance phase. Like it's not the approach that I think is entirely necessary, but if you want to do it, there's just not that much that you lose in the process aside from, you know, 8-12 weeks of time.
Yeah. If I had to speculate on it, I mean, certainly, obviously a lot of it is what you said, right? You have all this food bulk, the glycogen, that can quickly go away almost immediately if you start cutting. I think, you know, if I were to try to argue for maintaining it, maybe if you're not super advanced, that's just during that maintenance period, you are actually just continuing to gain a little bit of muscle or recomp it. If you want to call that solidifying it, like maybe you're just gaining a little bit more. If I think about on the way down, we do often see that, you know, somebody has a first contest and then in their next contest and the next contest, they seem to maintain muscle better. I imagine you would say they're probably just taking a smarter approach to dieting, not that physiologically their body has learned to hold on to it better.
Yeah, I would say that most likely. So yeah, the idea that you're getting at here is like repeat competitors notice that they retain more muscle in subsequent seasons, basically. I think that that just comes down to experience, you know, having a more effective off season, having a more effective cut. I will say, I think perception does play into this as well. So I remember my first competitive season as a bodybuilder. If you told me at the beginning, Eric, you're going to get down to 156 pounds at the end of this cut, I would have said, holy crap, I am going to be 3.5% body fat, absolutely shredded. The reality is I overestimated my muscle mass and I underestimated my fat mass. And you only do that once, you know, because you learn from it. And so I do think that a lot of what happens in season 2, 3, 4 and beyond is that you remember in season one when you're like,
yeah,
I didn't lose a ton of muscle. I never had the muscle. Right. I wasn't as big as I thought, and I had more fat than I thought. And so, yeah, I cut like 40 pounds for my first show and wasn't in that good of shape. Wow. And I would have thought it would take 30 to get absolutely like as shredded as a person would ever want to be. The reality was what I thought would take 30 pounds probably would have taken about 50. And so I think for sure. I had at least 10 pounds to go for sure. Wow. So yeah, I think that part of the experience of being a bodybuilder is starting to recognize over time, like, oh, hey, cutting's hard and you don't look exactly how you thought you would the first time. So you kind of recalibrate your expectations in terms of how much muscle you have, how much fat you have, and how much weight loss it's going to take to actually get in stage competition.
Sure. Yeah. You've done 3 competitions. Am I remembering that?
Oh no, I've done more than that.
Okay.
I don't remember how many competitions I've had. I think I've had 3 discrete competitive
seasons,
right? Okay. But like having multiple competitions per season, with the exception of my first one. The first season I just did one show and said, oh, that's what bodybuilding is. Okay.
Yeah.
And then the other ones I did more competitions because, you know, you might as well if you're going to the trouble of getting that lean. Yeah.
You said 156 your first show. Do you remember roughly what the other ones were?
Oh man, yeah, definitely into the 140s, like into the low to mid 140s. So yeah, not exactly what you would call a mass monster.
But you're how tall?
5'6", 5'7".
Right. So like, you know, based on what I see on the internet, if you were 6'1", that would be like 230 peeled, right? So
yeah. No, but I mean, the thing is, yeah, it's like I think honestly a lot of bodybuilders hold themselves back in natural bodybuilding because and really outside of bodybuilding as well. Like I know plenty of people who are just really stubborn and they got into lifting because they wanted to be huge. And so they say, well, I cannot get below 175 because like I would feel just very self-conscious about being a small, light person if I weighed under 175. And it's like, yeah, but dude, your physique goal insists that you must get below 175. And they say, well, then screw the goal. I'm not going to weigh under 175, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
So for me, yeah, I just was like, screw it, man. I'm just going to get as lean as I can. And yeah, I got into the low 140s, but looked like I weighed a hell of a lot more than that and, you know, won my pro card. And what are you going to do? Like, that's the way that the gravity works, I guess.
Well, if I'm recalling you, it's been a while since you've competed, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I know you and Greg have both had phases where you're taking it really seriously versus, I know when he was getting his master's, there was months where he was not as serious. I'm not sure where you are with it right now. if
there's months where he didn't even touch a weight,
right,
like several months in a row. Yeah.
So where are you with that? Like, if you were to compete next year, do you think you'd come in with your best package, or have you kind of taken a little time off or away maybe?
Oh God. Yeah. Definitely not competing next year. So I've been, working through, well, no, I haven't. I have an injury that is very painful and frustrating, and I have not been able to set aside the time to actually do anything about it. I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this. I went to go see some medical professionals, and those visits didn't go very well. Like, I don't know if you've ever run into this, but it's like you go in and you're like, so I know you think I have the number one most obvious thing, but like, I definitely right. don't. So right. can we entertain the possibility that it's the second or third most common thing? And they're like, yeah. absolutely not. And so like, I just keep bouncing back between hip specialists, and they say, oh, you have FAI. And then they bounce me to another person. They say like, dude, you clearly obviously don't have FAI. And I'm like, oh, cool. Then what should I do? And they're like, are you a praying man? Or, you know, like, and I'm like that. Well, that's not helpful. So fortunately, Jason Yeary Jason Yore. I always say his name wrong. Jason Yore is our physical therapist at Stronger by Science. And he honestly is a magician. He's a miracle worker. I didn't want to bother him. I didn't want to take up his time. He asked me like three questions and then gave me the most plausible, most accurate diagnosis out of any specialist I've seen. And they were all like literally cranking on my hip and doing all sorts of assessments. So he's incredible, but I haven't been proactive about actually rehabbing the way I'm supposed to, because I've just been swamped. But anyway, that's a long answer. Basically, I have a nerve entrapment issue that causes some hip and some abdominal pain. And it's made lower body training really rough, and even a lot of upper body training as well, just because of the abdominal element. It's like a lot of different exercises. You kind of forget how much abdominal muscular activity is involved. Sure. So, I've been focusing on just kind of training for health and happiness and well-being and longevity, and it's been going great. I do expect that in the future I will be back. I don't believe I've been in the best shape I've ever been in. Like I have all the confidence in the world that
you'll ever be in, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. I think my best physique ever is ahead of me. But it's way ahead of me. It's gonna take some time to get there, but that's okay. Like I'm not sweating that at all.
Yeah, that actually leads into something I want to talk to you about, as far as it's different positions, because that's a nice mindset to have, right? And there's the belief, okay, well, if right now I'm not training as seriously as I was, then obviously someday then I could get that back. And I think, unlike many sports, natural bodybuilding, there's that longevity, right? I think the reality is most sports, you tend to peak sometimes even 20s, right? I mean, something like gymnastics, it could be like, you know, low 20s. I just was looking up Usain Bolt's records the other day, and he hasn't beat his 100 meter time since he was 23 years old, right? So best genetics in the world, best training in the world, possibly, you know, some supplemental help there. And still 23 was where he maxed out. And then other times it's like in MMA, there are some guys who even go into like 40 or so, but bodybuilding, I mean, really, it seems like, not to put a hard number on it, but 50, let's say, you know, natural bodybuilding, I think you can stick around a lot longer. So that's a great position to be in. I would wonder, you know, like if I took my situation, we've been lifting exactly since 12, both 31. I've never really taken any extended period off. So I think for me, one of the problems I have is, do I have the belief that there's more there? And without that belief, I find it very hard to be motivated. Even if it was like, you're going to gain 1 pound in the next 2 years, like there's something there. And I wonder if that factors in with your own motivation. Like there's really no doubt, right, that you can improve from where you are. Do you feel like if you were in a similar situation of there was no breaks over 18 years, literally maybe, or a surgery, you took 2 weeks off or something, do you think you would switch focus towards just a different physical goal, or where do you think you'd be in a similar situation?
Yeah, I think everybody wrestles with that a little bit differently. I remember, first of all, talking about kind of different peaks and when you peak for different sports. I think a huge thing to consider is how much the sport depends on explosiveness and just power rather than strength. So like Greg has done some excellent work where if you're doing Olympic weightlifting, if you're doing sprinting, you know, that type of thing, high explosiveness, usually a lot of times people peak in their 20s. Now there are some people who have, you know, broke the norm there and have excelled at higher ages. But generally speaking, the 20s is kind of the time to strike. Power lifters can go, you know, much further than that. A lot of power lifters still get stronger into their 30s and 40s. Dave Ricks is just an absolute freak. He's like in his 60s, I think, and is just putting up silly numbers still. And then bodybuilders can go even further because I mean the requirement for explosiveness is so minimal, and if you're training with longevity in mind, you can really extend a long career if hypertrophy is the goal. But Greg and I had a podcast where we interviewed Mike Tuchscherer, and I'm pretty sure Mike Tuchscherer won a world championship in 2009, like when Greg and I were in high school. So we were talking to Mike. I mean, Mike is still killing his training. He's still very, very strong. And he used the metaphor of turning over rocks, just, you know, like you can imagine like in a little creek bed, just looking for stuff. Turn over a rock, see what you find underneath it. Is it something good? Who knows? Move on to the next rock. And he said, you know, yeah, I've been a world-class strength athlete since 2009. That was many, many years ago. But he said, I'm going to keep turning over rocks. And, you know, obviously the returns diminish over time. But once you get to that level where you've been doing things generally pretty well for a decade or two, you get to the point where things aren't going to be linear anymore, right? You're going to turn over a rock, find a new thing that you haven't tried, find that you respond to it better than the average person does, and you make a leap. You know, it's about making those leaps, just getting an extra like chunk of progress and continuing to turn over those rocks and find areas in which you kind of deviate from the norm. Like when you're at that stage in your career, you're not going to find your answer in a meta-analysis that says, hey, did you know that training two times a week is better than one? You're past that, right? Like the basic stuff that generally works for the general person, typically most of the time in most cases, you're past that. You know, you're into that phase where you have to say, okay, I've been optimizing that stuff for 30 years. Now what? And that's where you get into those situations where you start looking for a really individualized, you know, when I tweak these things just the right way, do I respond better than the typical person? Or does it take me from where I'm at to where I'm trying to get? And yeah, realistically, it's not going to be, you know, if Mike Tuchscherer, you know, adds 150 pounds to a squat, I'm going to be very surprised, right? But if he adds 25, I'm not. You know, I mean, you know, that's realistic stuff to make the kind of, I don't even want to call it incremental improvement, because at that point, it really is about that individualization and tailoring. And it's about making those nonlinear jumps when you find, you know, the particular strategy that's going to work well for you.
How old is Mike now?
Old enough to be a world champion in 2009. I don't know. I think I don't want to guess. Yeah. I'm not really sure, but I don't know.
I would guess mid 40s, but I don't know.
That sounds reasonable to me.
Yeah. So let's say, you know, low 30s when he became world champion. Do you know, is he significantly stronger than he was in 2009, or has he mostly maintained a peak performance?
I really don't know. And that's an interesting question, because powerlifting was a different world in 2009. I mean, right. You know, you look at the record books and yeah, they basically started over, you know, in just in terms of how much stronger people have gotten in the past, really just the past decade or so. I don't really know, but I thought it was very interesting to just pick his brain about, you know, from someone who's been that good for that long? Like, how do you find that motivation? And basically his answer was, I'm still thrilled by the chase. I find it to be exhilarating when I turn over the next rock and I find, oh, hey, that actually worked. Good stuff. So yeah, I mean, you know, for someone like me, like I'm actually, you know, I'm excited because I know that when I'm ready to shift into that next gear, there's so much progress on the table. There's so many gains to be had.
Right.
But yeah, I think when you start getting to that level, the question you have to ask yourself is, does it still excite you when you turn over the rock and you find out it works pretty well and you make that incremental progress or that small chunk of progress? If it stops exciting you when it goes well, then I think you have to dig a lot deeper and start to say, okay, well, that stuff doesn't excite me. That can't really be the main goal anymore.
Yeah.
There's got to be something else to train for, you know, whether it's competitive placing or longevity or health or wellness or, you know, whatever the case may be. And sometimes, I mean, I've heard of people who thought they were a strength athlete and did it for 15 years and then said, I'm going to run a marathon. And now like getting them to lift is a chore. They're like, I don't feel like it. It's not fun.
Yeah.
And they just completely change. So I think if the little progress stops exciting you, that usually is an indicator that you need to get back to the drawing board and do some pretty introspective thought and really dig deep and figure out what does excite you. How might you incorporate some type of fitness or exercise or training into your life in a way that truly is in alignment with your goals deep down, the stuff that actually gets you excited and makes you happy?
Yeah. And I think that is actually a really important topic. And I imagine there's, you know, maybe some people who are tired of hearing me talk about some of the same things here. But I think one of the reasons I do is because I remember when I was, I don't know, 2 years into lifting, and I was posting, I had one of the, this guy, Mark, I'm forgetting his name. But this was like when like everybody had eBooks and everything back then. And like, so he had a forum called discussbodybuilding.com that's not there anymore. And I had well over 10,000 posts on there. So I remember asking like, so what do you do when you're done? And this is when I wanted to be like 220, very lean. I was like, so what do you do when you're like done? I mean, you were like, you might not never get there. And I was like, what do you mean? You know? And I think it's helpful to have a perspective of somebody who's 15 or 20 or 25 years into it and say, hey, look, if you're going to do this for life, like maybe these are some of the things that are going to come to mind. So that is also one of the reasons that I talk about it. But I found that myself with trying to get excited about things, which has been my big task over the last, let's say, 4 years, where I haven't seen much tangible progress. You know, I worked with Steve Hall for 6 months, and at the end, we kind of concluded, hey, not a lot happened, but honestly, it was nice to be pretty excited about something new. And even now, like I'm back to a routine that I basically did for like 3 years, and I'll be lifting after this podcast. And part of me, I literally thought about just doing something else. And just the thought, I didn't even have something in mind. The thought of doing something else was just exciting because I've just been doing this routine too damn long, you know? And that's, I think, a point where you get to where you do, I think all of the questions, those first 5-10 years, is like, what is optimal? What's going to give me this? And personally, it's like, I don't ever want to drop that. I almost have too much of a, I don't know, pride and allegiance towards finding what works well. But there is a point where it's like, look, can I find something that's 90% quote unquote optimal, but I'm actually excited to do it every time I go, or most of the time, versus, you know, sometimes you just have to do something that is going to work even if you're not excited. Like, I wasn't excited for studying for 20 years, but it got me a great outcome, right? So sometimes,
yeah,
especially as a competitor, you certainly have to do things. But if you're not competing, I wonder how much of it just becomes like, this is what I enjoy, you know, that keeps me going.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of times when you talk to people who have been doing it for a long time and they're not making huge strides with their physique anymore, but they're still doing it and they're still loving it, the reason that they're excited is because their excitement becomes decoupled from the outcome. Mm-hmm. Their excitement is tied to the process. It's a process-oriented focus versus an outcome-oriented focus. And so you will ask someone, hey, dude, you've been lifting for 35 years. You've looked the same for the last 15 of them. The hell are you doing? Mm-hmm. You know, it's move on. And it's not about, you know, gaining 3 pounds of muscle over the next 2 years. It's about, I like going into the gym. I like the routine of it. I like knowing that I made a positive step for my health and longevity today. I like the feeling of the pump. I like that when you get that nice mind muscle connection and things are just clicking, right? It becomes very process oriented, and the subjective experience of the training session is almost as important, if not more important, than the objective outcome that is yielded from the training session. And so I think a lot of folks that kind of, you know, I mean, I talked about Mike Tushier. I mean, he would love for great objective progress outcomes. And that certainly is still the goal, but you know, part of the reason that he's still great at it after so many decades is he loves the process of seeking that next thing and trying new things and seeing how they work and incorporating that into the athletes he works with. I mean, at a certain point, I do think you have to I don't want to be too general. Don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but I think a lot of people notice that they are able to find more of that happiness and excitement when they start to decouple enjoyment of training with just purely objective adaptations or training outcomes. If you can start to be really intrinsically motivated by the process rather than the outcome, I think that can go a very long way. And I mean, with my training right now, I mean, am I at my best physique ever? Of course not, not even close. But I get into the gym. I'm doing one of my favorite training splits, nice push pull legs routine. I love that routine. I love getting in there. The duration of the sessions is perfect. The frequency is perfect. I get a nice pump, plenty of volume per session. I love the process of what I'm doing right now. And, you know, the gains will materialize with time. I've been around long enough to know that. So for me, I know that the general construction of this program, the general framework is effective. So for me, the day-to-day task is to go in and have fun and enjoy it and you know, engage in that process and just kind of let the other stuff sort itself out and let the gains materialize.
And I wonder how much of that has to do with, well, for those who are, let's say, maintaining mostly, being relatively good at that thing, like a Jeff Alberts, I've only recently heard him finally say, well, at my age now, I think he's about 50, you know, there, like he said, there might not be any more on the table. I don't think 45-year-old Jeff would have said that, but I think he is kind of finally started to say that. But he's also at the top, right? Percentage wise of all natural bodybuilders, he's up there. Or alternatively, having a belief that there is another stone to turn over, right? Like if you truly believe nothing else is going to happen versus somebody who believes, no, there is still something left. This is, I mean, I talk a lot, not a lot, but I do mention, I oftentimes find some bodybuilders fairly delusional with certain things. But at the same time, it's like, who am I to say, don't keep trying for something, because I would never want to take away somebody's passion or belief in themselves. And if you can find a 1% here or a 0.5% here, that's great. Like sometimes I wish I could give myself that back.
Well, one thing that I think is really helpful for competitors is the way that competitive organizations start to sort themselves out with master's categories. And so I think you could, example, if you're a master's bodybuilder, you could say, I've reached my peak muscularity. I'm not going to have more lean mass in any future competition. However, can I enhance my placement relative to other people in a similar situation, right? Can I be, you know, in the 50 to 60 year old category, can I be the most muscular one there? Can I make strides and progress within that category so that I'm competing within the category, not competing with a version of me that existed 15 years ago, right? Yeah. So I do think with competition, you know, I think when you reach that point, you say, okay, my official athletic peak is behind me in whatever pursuit I enjoy. I think there are many paths forward, which could involve trying something totally different. It could enjoy focusing on competitive outcomes versus personal best ever, because personal best ever might not be on the table anymore.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of different directions that you can take, you know, and the other option, like I said, is just to really start to become a lot more process oriented rather than outcome oriented. So there's a little bit in there for everybody. If you want to be really exhilarated by a brand new experience and a brand new set of adaptations, go become an endurance athlete, become the fighter, you know, go do some submission wrestling, right? Get into jujitsu. Like, I mean, do something completely different. You might love it. Be a rock climber, right? There's so much other stuff you can do to get your body moving and watch it changing it better. But yeah, there's so many different routes you can take. But the one route that I would advise against is just getting on the little hamster wheel and saying, well, I'm doing this only because I've always done it. And I'm very dissatisfied because I'm not getting any better. But I simply don't have the curiosity to try anything else or to do any introspective thinking and figure out what's going to make me happy. Like the only path that I consider to be not viable at all, or at least not advisable, is just going through the motions and doing the same thing, even though it very much dissatisfies you. I don't think that that's the right path forward.
For sure. Yeah. And I would have to admit I was on that path for a year or two, probably partly what led to working with Steve Hall. And even now, like I said, I'm not worried about losing much. It's more like, you know, trying new things to, again, mostly for that excitement. But the competition was a aspect I was going to bring up because I think of tennis, and a lot of people who play tennis, especially 40 plus year olds, they know this isn't peak performance, perhaps if they got into it younger, but, and they, you know, probably an important point is a lot of them do not practice that often, right? They're not just there practicing, but the competition is fun for them, right? And there's always, this is the same thing with fighting. You might not be any better fighter for years, but depending on who shows up, you might still win, right? Or I guess you could say that with bodybuilding too, right? Who shows up. So there's that inherent fun and competitiveness that even if you're worse, you're maybe also playing against people who are worse, right? Like you said about the age categories. So I think that's a great way to keep a lot of that stuff fun. Probably doesn't apply as much to the, I don't want to call it casual lifter, but the non-competitive lifter. But at least in that case, you still have the health aspect too, right? Like even if you do not care to compete at all, we should all be lifting, let's say a couple times per week at least, right? For a lot of health benefits. So that's at least a nice stimulus to get you going.
Yeah, for sure.
With your wrestling background, did you ever consider jiu-jitsu with how popular it's become?
You know what? A funny story. I was 18 years old and my wrestling season almost came to an abrupt end because I had multiple concussions within a single year.
Yeah.
It was really weird because I played football, never had concussion issues, but then had one concussion from wrestling. You know, with wrestling, you start on the bottom, the other person's on the top, they blow the whistle. It's very common for the person who starts on top to return you to the mat, basically pick you up and slam you back down. That's kind of just the way the sport works. Like, you know, you're trying to escape, they have the upper hand. So you find yourself in many situations where it's very easy for someone to pick you up and slam you back on the mat, you know, almost, you know, by design. And so that was the situation where within a match, somebody picked me up, returned me to the mat. Return is a polite word. They slammed me to the mat, head smacked it, you know, concussion. But then, man, they say once you've had concussions, your risk for future concussions is significantly increased. And that was very true for me because, very shortly after I got my second and then extremely shortly after I got my third.
Wow.
And they're like, not sure if they're going to let me wrestle my senior year. I basically just sat around the entire season. They said I couldn't train because like even just getting my heart rate and my blood pressure up would interfere with kind of the recovery from the concussion. Cause it was, you know, when you get two and very rapid back to back, they get very cautious about recovery. So yeah, just kind of sat around all year. And then right when the postseason was about to start, they're like, all right, you can go give it a shot if you want. So I came in so out of shape, just bloated, two weight classes higher than I expected. But you know, it actually wasn't that bad of a postseason. But anyway, after that, I was like, I think I want to get into not jujitsu, but mixed martial arts. I want to do the whole deal with striking and everything.
Really?
And yeah, so I had a coach, one of my wrestling coaches was into mixed martial arts, and we started, you know, doing a little jujitsu, doing a little striking practice. And then there was one day where I caught a pretty stiff punch to the face. And I remember thinking, with my concussion history, this just isn't going to work, you know? Yeah. And I was 18, so I was about to go off to college in like 2 months. And I was like, I need to have a functioning brain to do the things I want to do in life.
Yeah.
So I decided not to pursue mixed martial arts and just kind of left it at that, got into powerlifting and bodybuilding. And there you go. Now I'm here. I have gotten more and more interested in jiu-jitsu as I've been dealing with this injury, just because the types of lifting I like to do are temporarily hard to stick with. But I haven't made the jump just yet. So mixed martial arts is totally off the table, but jiu-jitsu is still one of those things that kicks around in the back of my head. And I wouldn't be shocked if I got back into it within the next like 5 or 10 years. You know, I was really annoyed because I started getting into endurance running again when I was running into those issues with lifting. Mm-hmm. And at first it was great and I was having a lot of fun. It totally scratched the itch. But unfortunately the running, just because of the repeated hip flexion, it aggravated the same injury that makes it difficult for me to squat and deadlift and even do, you know, squat and deadlift variations for the time being. And I don't want people to think I'm like catastrophizing. I'll be back. I'll be able to do those lifts in the future, but I have to actually put in the work to do the rehab. And I just haven't found the time and the, frankly, the effort to do it. Right. So that'll
really the old guys now, man, we're in our 30s. It's we can't just go back anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll get back there. And yeah, endurance running is something that, you know, once the hip and abdomen issue is sorted out, you know, maybe I'll get into that as well. I don't know. But the thing that I think is really important is just having stuff in the future on the horizon, even if it's hypothetical, but stuff that just you say, you know what, that would be fun. I think I would like that. I would, that would be exciting. And, you know, maybe you end up doing some of them, maybe you end up doing none of them, but I do think it's very psychologically healthy to have your eggs, even if they're not distributed among many baskets, at least knowing the other baskets exist. You know, there are so many people who all of their eggs are in powerlifting. And they're like, if anything were to happen and I couldn't do powerlifting, I would be a shell of my former self. I would have no identity. I would have no self-worth. I would be nothing without powerlifting. And here's the thing, car accidents happen, you know, training injuries happen, right? So I think it's really important to have at least just to know there are other things I could do, even if the worst were to happen. And let's say this hip thing, I'm very certain I'll be able to sort it out once I start actually listening to Jason. It's funny. He'll message me every now and then and say, "Hey, how's your rehab going?" I'm like, you know, I haven't done anything. Come on. But no, it's important to make sure that you're still like considering like other things that can be fulfilling and keep you engaged with exercise. Cause you know, we, if we're lucky, we get quite a few decades, in this life and, you know, we have to be willing to like transition to some other things when circumstances change. So like, I feel very happy about the fact that I'm very confident that I'll be back and my physique will be better than ever. But even if it doesn't work out, whatever, then I'll be a runner. I'll go hiking a lot. I'll take up bird watching. Like there's a lot of fun stuff to do in life. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a great mindset, man. I have one more topic if you have the time.
Sure.
So you guys talked about a recent study on, and it was on postmenopausal women, but it basically talked about this large variation in response with different loading patterns, right? And I think the idea was to discuss, okay, well, just because these two means aren't that different doesn't mean there's not going to be a big difference for you. So I have a point related to that, but maybe you could just elaborate on that study first.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure Greg wrote about this, but you know, I if I'm thinking of the correct one, basically, yeah, there was two different loading protocols. I think it was high load versus low load. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's pretty common for people to say, hey, what rep range should I be using and stuff like that. And you know, basically the results indicated, looking at the group averages, both types of training did pretty similar. And so a lot of people just looked at that, left it at that, and said, cool, then both are equally effective and I can use both of them interchangeably. And that's not necessarily the explicitly correct conclusion, right? So you could look at it and say, if I went out and found two groups of people and randomly allocated them, then their average responses would be similar both ways. But when you dig into the results a little bit deeper, you see that for some individuals, you know, high load was way more effective than low load. And for other individuals, you know, the inverse was true. And so it's basically the indication was, broadly speaking, at the population level, we cannot say that one is going to be unequivocally more effective than the other. But at the individual level, it probably does make sense to do a little bit of experimentation and see what works most effectively for you as an individual. So it's important to recognize that, you know, two similar changes in group averages, that does not mean that everyone responds to both programs exactly the same way.
Sure. And I think this study is, let me see, different load intensity transition schemes to avoid plateau and no response and lean body mass gain in postmenopausal women. So for people who are interested. And I think conceptually, I totally agree. I think it was something I talked with Eric Helms about, where I said to him, you know, I don't know if I've really, I had a trainer ask me one time, well, you know, so what have you found worked really well and what didn't work well? And I was like, I've done so many things, to be honest, I haven't noticed this huge difference. And Eric Helms was saying, well, you know, that is more the norm, but certainly there are people who will notice these big differences. So I can't say, well, high volume or low volume was dramatically different, or high reps versus low reps was dramatically different, et cetera. But I do understand and believe that that can be very different for different people. So I think it's worth experimenting with. Something in that study, and again, I know there's just one study, but it just kind of made me think about, on the whole, like you guys talked about that fruit study, and you mentioned, you know, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was something like removing a serving of fruit caused some absurd, what was it, 10 pounds of fat loss or something ridiculous over a short period of time.
Yeah, there was basically like, yeah, the intervention, which was in patients with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, it was basically like, hey, we're going to tell half the participants to like cut down fruit intake a little bit, and tell the other half to eat a little bit more fruit. You know, these were not large changes in daily fruit intake. You know, that, and yeah, basically like the one group lost like 10 or 15 pounds of fat. The other group gained like 10 or 15 pounds of fat. It ultimately ended up in a divergence of about 30 pounds in terms of weight change.
Yeah.
But yeah, go on.
So the point is, like, that study, you look at that and you say, well, because these conclusions are so strong, right? Or because these results are so strong, something's wrong. Like, nobody would actually believe that, right? I mean, literally almost nobody would believe that.
Right.
However, if I go back to this menopausal study, I think Greg was saying how, and I think just for people who want to see your video on it, the title was something like, no difference among this does not equal no difference for you. It was like 2 weeks
ago. Yeah.
And it some of the results that he was talking about was, okay, in this, in like, whether it was low load or high load first, they had done both, each group did both. And it was like, well, in this one, the women lost several pounds of muscle. And then when they switched to this, they actually gained, you know, even more muscle. And when I hear that, I have to think, you're telling me that these women lost actual muscle tissue with, let's say, a high load, low rep training. And then they actually gained like twice as much when they went to the opposite. The first thing that comes to mind is, did they just have an error in measurement? Because if this is where they actually are, and then the first one was an error in this direction, then even just getting it correct the second time would show this big gain, right? Or you could have an error even further up. So that was the first thing that came to my mind. The second thing that came to my mind was, okay, if even a study like the fruit one, where, you know, oftentimes we see studies that show a small benefit of whatever intervention, and we say, well, it's a small benefit, so is it really legit? But even here, it's like, well, this was such a large benefit, we also have to question it. So it's like, not to be anti-science at all, obviously, but it's just like, okay, so if a study has a huge benefit, we really got to question it. if it's small benefit, we got to question it because maybe it's just, you know, there's not, it's not powered enough or whatever. I guess this is more of a rant than anything, Eric, but it's just kind of like, okay, so what are we looking at here?
Yeah, I think it can be, so science interpretation is a practice that requires a tremendous amount of patience, right? So like, for example, Greg and some of his colleagues were seeing papers by a particular researcher. They were a bit skeptical of the findings. And the reality is, you know, they decided, okay, we're going to actually like thoroughly investigate this, contact journals, try to see if we can get some more clarification. The reality is what they were signing up there for there was a multi-year process before any clarity was to be achieved, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, this stuff can take forever. It can be immensely frustrating. But the important thing is that research, when reported effectively, gives us the tools to thoroughly poke and prod at findings to see if we can get more clarity, right? And the nice thing about science is that findings do not exist exclusively in a vacuum. If something is a true, repeatable observation, we should be able to compare and contrast with existing literature and kind of test the robustness of a particular finding. So while it is surprising that someone could experience a small reduction, even an untrained person can experience a small reduction in lean body mass or lean soft tissue in response to resistance training or muscle thickness, for example, that is surprisingly a repeatable observation that has been observed many times. Now, is it possible that what we're seeing there is a true change of essentially roughly approximately zero, and the fact that measurement error should distribute both on the positive and the negative side of any measurement, and no measurement's perfect, right? So measurement error is present in all studies. You know, that's an argument that could certainly be made. But at that point, if we're talking about a small reduction versus a change in zero, we're effectively talking about pretty much the same thing. You know, when we're talking about small magnitudes. One of the things that is important to keep in mind with the fruit study, you know, so the findings were large, and I wouldn't call them strong. I would call them large in magnitude, because I think strong implies a degree of validity and reliability that I would not attribute to those findings. But the thing is, you can look at other studies and say, okay, well, what happens when people make small changes in fruit intake? That's been observed, and they don't, you know, have a 30-pound difference in fat mass. We can look at studies with diet interventions in people from that exact population with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. We can look at that and say, do we really believe that reducing fruit intake by like 1.2 servings a day is the most effective fat loss protocol that's ever been studied in non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? Probably not. Probably nobody believes that to be true, especially when you cross-reference it with the reported calorie intake data. So like, it can be very frustrating on the surface level, but as you dig deeper and lean on some statistical tools, you can start to say, okay, well, let's start to sort out some of this mess and get to the bottom of it. So if the goal of science is to have no findings in the literature that lack robustness and generalizability, like if the goal is to have a pristine literature with no flukes and no errors, then science is an abject failure. Yeah. But that's never the goal. The goal is, okay, let's do our best to try to lean on the very imperfect peer review process. Let's collect the literature that's available, and let's sort through that to see what kind of robust conclusions can be drawn. And then, you know, like you mentioned, with some of those studies with small changes, of course, you know, small changes are hard to sort out just by the nature of the tiny magnitudes we're talking about there. But there are ways that you can dig into it and say, okay, well, what is the typical error of the measurement technique taken? And then you can kind of say, okay, well, are these findings within the typical error, or do they exceed the typical error? And therefore, what's a plausible range of the true value here if we assume the greatest positive error and the greatest negative error that we can reasonably expect with this device? So basically the short version of the answer is shit's complicated, but shit isn't so complicated that it's an impossible nut to crack, right? We can lean on similar literature. We can lean on statistical analysis that incorporates an understanding of measurement error, and we can get to the bottom of these things and sort them out. And, you know, I think, Dave, you're really going to like, we've got an episode of our podcast that should be going up, I think in 6 days, which will be October 10th. I think that's a Monday, but, we've got a huge, it's like a 2-hour episode where Greg, I think, will address a lot of the questions that you have about the studies looking at individual responses and some of that variability. Greg will, in that podcast, he gets into the details about what actually contributes to some of this variability in strength gains and muscle gains in response to resistance training. And definitely measurement error is part of the mix, but Greg makes a very compelling case that the degree of variability we see in the data is way too large to be described in its entirety by measurement error. Because, like I said, we can quantify the anticipated range of measurement error based on reliability studies. So we can very safely write off and discard the concept that all the individual inter-individual variation we see is just measurement error. And then when you get into the other things that are contributing, then it gets a lot more difficult, right? So you can look at things like genetics. And then the question is, which gene? Probably at least 20, right? So that's tough. You can look at things like microRNA. You can look at things like ribosome differences. There are so many different factors that can contribute. And one of the issues with trying to sort those out is you'll find an individual study that'll say like, hey, we're going to look at ribosomes. Is it important? Answer, yes. We're going to look at this genotype, you know, this specific gene. Is this important? Answer, yes. We're going to look at, you know, microRNA responses. Is it important? Yes. But the reality is that all of these different things will have some degree of correlation with one another, but not a perfect degree of correlation with one another. And that makes it tricky, because if they had perfect correlation with one another, then we could say, okay, well, then this one is a proxy for all the others. Fine. No sure. Big deal. Now we can predict it. The problem is they are, in most cases, they'll have some degree of correlation, but not perfect correlation. What we're probably looking at is a series of several different factors that contribute to these individual differences in responses to training. The vast majority of them probably are not super modifiable, broadly speaking, but that doesn't mean that someone with a below average response to training is just out of luck. You know, there are some things in that episode. Greg talks about a number of ways that someone could assess their gains to figure out exactly how atypical they are, because I think a lot of people underestimate how much variability there is in responses to training, and therefore they might say, oh my God, my gains are so terrible. I'm a total outlier. I have to be doing something wrong. And the reality is they're in like the 25th or the 35th percentile, which is not an abnormal response. You know, if you were to go get a blood test for some hormone and the doctor said, hey, you're in the 35th percentile, you're in the reference range, you're in the normal range. They wouldn't say, oh my God, what happened with this test? You know, we have to try it again. So I think a lot of people fail to appreciate the sheer magnitude of variability that should be expected based on the data. And so that's one part, is just getting a better understanding of how much variability really exists. But then the next question is, okay, you're below average with your gains, whether you're in the second percentile or the 48th percentile, what can you do about that? You know, and so he goes into a lot of detail about different things you can try. Many of them, guess what, Dave? Spoiler alert, they're pretty obvious. But he didn't go that right. He did mention sleep. So yeah, get all your normal stuff figured out, sleeping well, eating well, you know, basic training program design, etc. You know, but what's useful about the segment, in my opinion, is, you know, Dave, you know, you mentioned some of the shortcomings of science. One of the nice things about science is sometimes we can get empirical confirmation of stuff that seemed obvious. And the reason we need that is because there are things that seem obvious that aren't true. And we never get empirical confirmation, right? But there are studies where people who appear to be non-responders based on rigorous testing become responders and do display positive responses if they stick to the same thing for a longer period of time. There are instances where all they have to do is double or triple the training dose, and all of a sudden non-responders become responders. And then, of course, there are studies where they say, hey, you were a non-responder on a low volume program or a, you know, low load program. Let's flip you to the opposite of that. And lo and behold, people go from being a non-responder to a responder. And, you know, are there statistical elements that go into that? Regression to the mean, measurement error. Of course, those things are going to be present in any study. If you can find a way to get rid of them, let me know. Good luck.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, it is interesting to look at, within science, you know, we have to scrutinize the small findings and the big findings and the moderate findings. We have to scrutinize all of it. And really all the tools we have are how does this fit with the rest of what we observe? Are there any glaring errors, and are there any statistical crutches that we can lean on to figure out how plausible or implausible these findings are? You know, so the game of interpreting research is one where you have to be very comfortable with uncertainty and very comfortable with probabilities that are between 0 and 1, and making inferences accordingly.
Yeah, no, all great stuff. I think anybody who I had a probably my longest solo video on the channel was a recent one on genetics, and it's about 40 minutes long. So if you have time, you might enjoy it, Eric. But it got a lot of talk, and all the stuff you said about percentiles and all of that will sound very familiar to people who saw that video. So totally agree on all of that. And then as far as the, obviously I'm critical of science as I'm critical of everything, but you know, obviously
we should and must be critical of science. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. But, no, obviously I am very in favor of the scientific process. It's a big part of what I do. I do come across a lot of studies, and even in my field, I do things outside of fitness sometimes, but a lot of studies on drugs that have come out and things. And, I would say there's definitely a Dunning-Kruger effect with people who are initially just getting into the scientific process, I should say, where maybe they don't quite understand all the things you just said about how a single study doesn't mean this or that. And it's just interesting to see, because if anything, I become more critical, which I think is a good thing, over time, where you see something, especially if it's like a drug rep who's mentioning this study or that study. It's like, all right, well, let's see a little bit more. And, you know, how was the study actually conducted? And like you said, all of these other factors. So not to get so into that rabbit hole, but it is a very interesting topic. I'm sure we could go on for a long time about it. But I think I agree with everything you said.
Yeah, I mean, I probably shouldn't open that can of worms. But anyway, yeah, there's there in the past couple of years, there have been a few papers that have come up, and I've kind of gained more credibility among the people in my life, like personally, because in the last couple of years, people have like sent me a paper and said, oh my God, can you believe this finding? And I've looked at it and said, I promise you, within the next 12 months, that paper will be retracted. Retractions have been going crazy the last couple of years, which is important. You know, it's important. I'd rather have them, you know, unreliable studies retracted than not retracted. But I do think it'd be pretty cool if we didn't have to retract so many studies, because maybe we like tried the first time and said like, hey, this doesn't seem correct or well done. But no, I mean, yeah, it's, yeah, you always have to scrutinize these studies and be really, really critical, even when they seem intuitive. You still have to dig into it and say, wait a minute, what? How come this has a third of the variability of every other study like it? Yeah. That's not a good sign, right? You have to dig into that stuff. But most importantly, I'm just absolutely jarred by the fact that your longest solo video is 40 minutes, because I don't think Greg and I have ever talked about something for less than an hour and a half. We are physically incapable of it, and that is to our own detriment.
But you're bouncing everyone, off each other. This was just strictly me monologuing. So
yeah, but everyone tells us, please shorten the segments. And we promise that we will. And we just can't do it. We never have. And it's becoming very unlikely that it'll ever occur.
Well, at some point, I know it's hard to coordinate multiple people, but I will have to get you and Greg back on because I'm looking at this list of things to talk to you about. And I think I got to like two of them, and then they all spun into other things I was interested in. So it's a never ending cycle there.
Yeah. I'd be happy to come back on for sure.
Awesome, man. Well, where can people find your stuff?
Well, on social media, I'm most active on Instagram, and I'm not very active, but yeah. I exist there. So my handle is @TrexlerFitness. More importantly, a lot of my content you can find at StrongerByScience.com. Mass, the research review, you can find that at StrongerByScience.com/mass. And the big exciting thing is that we've got the Macro Factor diet app, which we developed. It's a little over 1 year old. It's a really, really efficient food logger, and it also has built-in coaching. So like it'll tell you like what your macro target should be based on various goals ranging from weight gain to weight loss, a lot of different customizations in terms of how much protein you like to eat, whether you like to be on a high carb, low carb, moderate carb program, stuff like that. So it's a very flexible, very efficient tool. Really good weight trending features so that you don't get too distracted by short-term fluctuations on scale weight. And we just implemented, I think literally like yesterday, recipe sharing, which is something a lot of people were clamoring for. So now, you know, you have like your whole recipe put together item by, it's not just like sending the macros of the recipe. You can actually send to another Macro Factor user the entire recipe, and they can customize and edit from there every single ingredient and amount. So we have a really active development timeline for Macro Factor. We continue to roll out these features and we think it's pretty cool. So you should check it out.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. I've had other people mention recently that, MyFitnessPal is now charging for some of their features, like with the barcode. And so
yeah, they put their barcode their barcode scanner behind the paywall. So yeah. Now just to like scan your protein bar or your protein shake, you can no longer do that with the free version. So yeah, for ours, we have the barcode scanner and all that stuff. We've got recipe sharing. We even have something called AI Describe where you can verbally speak to your phone and you hit the button and you say 8 ounces of chicken breast and one, you know, sweet potato and 200 grams of sour cream, whatever. Not quite a meal, but you get
quite
the idea.
A bit of sour cream.
Yeah. So, but anyway, you just talk into it and you tell it the food item and the quantity, and it won't just like transcribe it into text. It'll actually give you those food entries and the quantity and just say, is this what you want to log? And you just say yes. And so like, yeah, it's been amazing to see that feature. Like that one blew me away. And we've had that since day one, actually.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, so like a lot of people are like, God, when I'm logging food, I have to go search the database and there's four wrong items. And, you know, and we use a verified database. So it's not like those other ones where there's like 11 entries and like 10 of them are wrong. Yeah, we don't have any of that. But no, for us, like, yeah, with the voice, the AI Describe feature, you literally just tell your phone in a sentence. You don't have to go food item by food item. You tell it all four food items and it'll do all four at once with the quantity and the unit that you selected or that you spoke. I think a lot of people, we do have a free trial. So if you just want to see how it works, but you don't want to like buy it yet, you can check it out for the free trial, see if you like it. And it's a pretty cool food logging experience for sure.
Awesome, man. Well, I will have links to all that below.
Cool. Thank you.